Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, December 8, 2014, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Good afternoon and welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of our Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call. Today's Courthouse Steps conference call is on Amtrak and the non-delegation doctrine at the U.S. Supreme Court. My name is Christian Corrigan, and I'm the Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call, and also that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're pleased to welcome our expert, Mr. C. Frederick Beckner III, who is a partner at Sidley Austin. And he attended the oral arguments this morning and is going to provide the roundup of what transpired, and as always, followed by your questions. A more complete bio of Mr. Beckner was provided to you in notice of the call, so I'll stop there and preserve more time for his presentation, followed by your questions. So, Mr. Beckner, the floor is yours.
Hi, good afternoon, everybody. Hi, again, this is Rick Beckner, and I attended the argument today of the AAR versus DOT case, which put at issue the ability to delegate to a government-chartered corporation potential rulemaking authority for corporations that potentially compete with private companies. The case was argued by Tom Dupree of AAR and Curtis Gannon for the government. I should start with two quick disclaimers. The first, I authored a brief for the Chamber of Commerce in support of AAR. All the opinions I'm expressing today are my own and should be attributed to the Chamber of Commerce. And second, Tom Dupree, who argued for the government, for the AAR against the government, is a pretty close personal friend. So I'm not sure how familiar everyone is with the case, so I'll try to set the table a bit and then quickly get to the court's reaction. The case, as you all know, involves Amtrak, which is a corporation established by the government. It's by statute denominated as a private corporation and not for profit, and it is expressly written in the statute that it is not an agency of the government. The statute that was particularly at issue is a pretty unique one, and it's nothing like I've ever come across in practice. Amtrak doesn't own its own tracks. Instead, it has a statutory right to use the tracks of the major freight railroads that own them. In the Passenger Rail Improvement Act, Congress basically directed Amtrak, this private for-profit corporation, and the Federal Rail Administration to jointly develop standards for measuring Amtrak's on-time service. And if Amtrak and the Federal Rail Administration could not agree on the metrics, the matter was to be submitted to arbitration by an arbitrator appointed by the Surface Transportation Board. The act does not say who the arbitrator is supposed to be. While this may sound a little innocuous, the metrics are used to determine basically whether the freight railroads are fulfilling their statutory obligation to host Amtrak's trains. And if the metrics show that Amtrak's performance is dipping, the Surface Transportation Board is basically empowered to undertake an investigation of the railroads and potentially issue penalties and damages against the railroads. AAR challenged the statute as a violation of the delegation doctrine and on due process grounds. They lost below before the district court, but the D.C. Circuit reversed the district court and held that this scheme was unconstitutional in violation of the delegation doctrine. The D.C. Circuit was particularly concerned about giving rulemaking authority to a private corporation that could then use that authority to harm a rival. It analogized it to giving General Motors regulatory authority over car safety that could be used to adopt regulations that might affect Ford and Chrysler, Mercedes-Benz, and the like. It was also concerned that this was a mechanism by which the government could avoid accountability for the resulting regulations because no government party was squarely responsible for the regulations at issue. as I noted, AAR had advanced the due process argument, but the D.C. Circuit didn't reach it. Before the Supreme Court, the government really advanced three arguments about why the D.C. Circuit got it wrong. They first argued that these metrics, that Amtrak had authority to participate in the development of them, weren't really laws. They weren't really regulations. They were really tools for measuring performance that would then guide the STB into whether the STB would undertake a enforcement action, but didn't have the force of law. Second, they argued that Amtrak was really sufficiently part of the government that it should count as a part of the government, for at least for delegation purposes. It said, regardless of whether the statute said it's a private for-profit corporation, that the board of Amtrak was all, with one exception, appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate, and the one member was in turn appointed by the other members who were. So the government argued that the government effectively controlled Amtrak, and thus there's no delegation problem. And then thirdly, the government argued at the end of the day, this provision, which ultimately required a disagreement between Amtrak and the Federal Rail Administration, if they disagreed on the metrics to be decided by an arbitrator, the government argued that that arbitrator, the statute could be read as requiring the appointment of a governmental employee, so that the ultimate decision maker would be an officer of the United States, thereby eliminating any delegation doctrine problems. Case was argued this morning at 11 o'clock. I think overall my impression is that it was well argued by both sides. I think it's hard to predict how the court will come out. Both sides got some pretty pointed questions overall. I would think it's fair to say that most of the four Democratic appointed justices, to varying degrees, expressed skepticism of AAR's position, a particular Justice Breyer. On the other hand, I think Justice Scalia and Roberts seemed to be pretty skeptical of the government's position. Kennedy and Alito asked fewer questions, and as is his wont, Justice Thomas didn't ask any questions. The Democratic justices were generally focused on the issue of what legal effect that these metrics had. There were questions about whether they were really just ways to identify standards that would allow the Surface Transportation Board to begin an investigation. They weren't conclusive of a violation. They by themselves didn't establish that the freight railroads had done anything lawful. So they were really more in the nature of sort of standards that private bodies adopt every day, and there's no delegation problems with the government relying on privately adopted standards in order to determine whether to take additional governmental action. Justice Breyer in particular was concerned that there is a host of ways in which the government relies on independent standards, standards that govern, say, internet transactions and exchange of internet information, and was very concerned that a decision here could have widespread implications beyond just the narrow and unique circumstances of this case. The Republican appointees, in particular Justice Scalia, seemed skeptical of the government's position that these regulations were just nothings, that they did seem to potentially limit the ability of the Surface Transportation Board to bring a lawsuit and enforcement action. There are also questions noting that they seem to have a practical real-world consequence, and that there was a dramatic change in the measurements of Amtrak's performance when these metrics were struck down. I think there was also a lot of concern voiced by some of the Republican justices and a little bit of the Democratic justices about the due process argument, which was not decided by the D.C. Circuit. There definitely seemed to be concern, at least underlying a lot of questions, about a regime in which, even if the Amtrak was a governmental agency, concerns about giving some sort of regulatory authority over even a governmental agency that is intended to compete in the marketplace as a private corporation, and whether you can have a regime where Amtrak and the FRA get together to decide what the regulation should be, and everyone else is sort of shut out of the process. So it would not surprise me that if the decision was going to be upheld, that it might be on due process grounds as opposed to non-delegation grounds. So that is sort of, in a thumbnail, how I thought the argument went. I think probably what's most productive is if I could help answer any questions you have about my thumbnail sketch of the argument.
All right. Well, now we'll open the floor to your questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. And after that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. So again, if you'd like to ask a question, press star and then the pound key. All right, looks like we had our first caller jump on the line.
Yes, what is the harm that's being alleged by the railroad here? Why are they in court? What are they complaining about?
Well, basically, the freight railroads were worried that these metrics, which measured on-time performance for Amtrak, were rigged so that they would tend to show Amtrak not having on-time performance, and that could then trigger the Surface Transportation Board bringing enforcement proceedings against the railroads to require them to give Amtrak more trackage time, if you will. The unique scheme here is, although Amtrak and the freight railroads don't compete for passengers or freight, they compete for scarce trackage rights. And any amount of time an Amtrak train is on the tracks is time that really the freight railroad can't be on that track in the same vicinity. And the railroads have to give Amtrak a certain amount of preference for its passenger rail train. And the railroads thought that these metrics were biased so that they would show Amtrak's performance being degraded when it was really Amtrak's fault, or that the metrics just couldn't be met for reasons having nothing to do with what the railroads were doing, and that they would then be subject to enforcement actions and regulatory prescriptions by the board that would give Amtrak even greater rights to use of their railroad tracks. Did that answer your question?
Oh, I think we muted it. So we've got two more questions now, and then our lines will be open. So again, if you'd like to get in line, press star and then the pound key.
Hi, this is Bill James with JPODS. And my question is relative to we're building these little ultralight personal rapid transit networks starting in Secaucus, New Jersey. And the big barrier to transportation innovation, similar to communications innovation before 1982, is the federal monopoly control over transportation rights of way, basically. Were there any arguments in this thing relative to the post-roads restriction in the Constitution, where the federal government is limited to nothing more than delivering letters and has no sovereignty to control rights of way?
No, that issue didn't focus at all on the government's in the arguments that were the oral argument today or in the briefing before the court. So I don't think anything that's going to be decided by the Supreme Court is going to touch on that issue at all.
Is there anybody in the...
Oh, looks like it cut him off. Sorry, we've got one more caller on the line, and then our lines will be open. So press star and then the pound key.
Yes, good afternoon, and thank you for the insightful comments. I'm just curious, I'm an Alan Dixler practitioner in New Jersey. I'm just curious how the argument that Amtrak really is a part of the government, how that argument seemed to be faring, because, you know, outside looking in, it seems to be... at least to me, the most obvious argument that Amtrak is part of the government, and it certainly is for First Amendment state action purposes. So I was just wondering if there was any feeling for how the justices were responding to that.
That's an excellent question, and you are right, for First Amendment purposes they are. The irony here is, in the First Amendment, there's a Supreme Court case called LeBron, which I always think of as LeBron James, but held that Amtrak is a governmental actor for the First Amendment, and basically said we don't care what the labels that Congress put on it about being private are not dispositive. And there was definitely questions and concerns about the fact that that holding wouldn't that holding be require the same, you know, Amtrak to be treated as a governmental entity here. The government led with LeBron here before the Supreme Court, but, you know, interestingly, before the D.C. Circuit and the District Court was very circumspect, if is maybe the right word, in their use of LeBron. Quite clearly, Amtrak is very uncomfortable with arguing it's a governmental agency, and you could see that early on in the litigation, the government really was not pressing LeBron in that argument very much, and the D.C. Circuit sort of took them to task in their opinion about their odd treatment of LeBron. Now, at the Supreme Court, they started...
Probably institutional politics, I would guess.
Yeah. Before the Supreme Court, they led with that. That was their first argument. Justice Kennedy responded by being pretty skeptical that just because they found it was a government actor for First Amendment purposes would answer the question of whether they should be a government actor for delegation doctrine purposes. On the other hand, you know, Justice Kagan seemed to be pretty strong in saying, look, the government's footprint is all over, fingerprints are all over this entity. Who cares about these labels? It's quite clearly a governmental actor. You know, it's funded by Congress. It's created by Congress. It's run by, you know, people who are appointed by the government. Justice Ginsburg also pointed out that LeBron had held that there was at least structural control of Amtrak by the government. The AAR responded by the fact that below, Amtrak had conceded, or the government conceded, that the government did not exercise any functional day-to-day control of Amtrak. But this is also where I think at least Justice Scalia's views were indicating that he might be open to saying it doesn't matter whether it's part of the government, because at the end of the day, this is a due process violation. And what's critical here is whatever view you might think it's part of the government, but it is given a mission to a private party mission and tasked with having operating itself not for the public interest, but operating itself in a way to, you know, to with a certain limited private interest, and, you know, giving it a kind of primary role in drafting these regulations raises due process concerns. Plus, you add on, even if Amtrak's part of the government, there still is this lingering issue of the arbitrator that ultimately is supposed to be appointed to decide a dispute between the FRA and Amtrak is not, by statute, is not, there's nothing in the statute that says that's supposed to be a governmental officer. And to some degree, the structure of the statute suggests that the arbitrator should be a third-party neutral. So I do agree that the government has a strong argument about Amtrak potentially being subject to government control, and that may be the way that the Supreme Court decides the case. But there were at least some indications that that may not carry the day by itself for the government.
All right. Well, it looks like we've had three questions jump on the line, so we'll go right to those. Again, if you'd like to get in line in the queue to ask a question, press star and then the pound key.
Hi, I jumped on the call late, so my apologies if this has already been answered, but when was the last time the non-delegation doctrine was successfully argued before the court?
You know, you're putting me on the spot here. I think it actually, before the Supreme Court, in this context, I think it is Carter versus Carter Cole, if I'm getting the name of the case right, which is a somewhat Lochner-era case. But there have been at least a number of appellate court decisions and some Supreme Court decisions which have indicated their approval of the doctrine with regard to delegations to private parties. The government, in their briefs, didn't fight too hard on the notion that that let's just say Congress, you know, authorized the Federal Society to set regulations governing membership in not-for-profit companies, that might raise concern. They weren't really questioning. There didn't seem to be too much of a debate about whether the government can delegate to purely private parties. Really, the debate in this case tended to be more on whether Amtrak was private, whether there was sufficient control, whether the fact that the Federal Rail Administration could veto anything Amtrak might have wanted to do, whether there was enough governmental control here to render, I'll call it the delegation in quotes, permissible.
Okay, well, we've got two more questions, and then our lines will be open.
Hi, this is Paul Salamanca at the University of Kentucky. I have a question about, I guess I'd call it law and economics, and whether something came up. It seems that Justice Breyer and Justice Scalia seem to have maybe switched perspectives between Florida Prepaid, if you remember that case, and this one. In Florida Prepaid, the argument was whether Florida essentially could sell an investment vehicle to prepay for college that essentially emulated something in the private sector. And Justice Breyer said that Florida Prepaid should not be able to assert sovereign immunity because they've entered the market, and it would be a distortion of the market not to let them assert sovereign immunity and escape liability. And Justice Scalia responded with an essentially formalist argument saying, well, we've never micromanaged state governments and so on and told them how to organize their affairs. They seem to have switched their positions here, with Justice Breyer taking a formalist approach and ignoring the economics of the situation, where Amtrak, as you say, is competing with CSX and Norfolk Southern for track rights. And now Justice Scalia seems to be taking the more economically sensitive position. Did that come up in an explicit way, or did that just stay under the radar?
There was not an explicit way, but there was a hint at it in a long question Justice Breyer wrote or asked, which maybe I can find while we're talking, which I confess went on for quite some time. There was a question where he hinted that there are antitrust / economic concerns with giving private parties regulatory authority over their competitors. And I know it's established in the antitrust context that there can be areas where private companies basically take control of the standard setting process in a way to freeze out competitors, and it can be quite an effective way to freeze out competitors. Here's what he wrote, and I'll read it. Said, "My reaction was the way you deal with that normally is that the statute would be interpreted not to give them the authority to write any competitive regulations, and you'd attack it under the antitrust laws. There may be other ways to do it. I've never heard of an example where the due process problem really was a constitutional problem under due process." What I think he was trying to get at is you should be looking for ways to either, if you have this problem, you should either read the statute as not giving the private company the authority, or you would strike down the regulation kind of under an APA type of argument that there is an anti-competitive aspect of what is going here. So he seemed to at least that indication there, he seemed to be recognizing there were some functional concerns, but it wasn't clear how he was really proposing it, they could be addressed in this case in a concrete way.
Okay, thank you.
All right, looks like we still have two questions on the line. We're only to about 3:30. So if you'd like to get in and ask a question, press star and then the pound key.
Hi. So just very quickly, in answer to the question that was asked earlier about when was the last time the Supreme Court struck something down under the non-delegation doctrine, it was Carter Cole, and that was almost the first time also. Carter Cole and Schechter Poultry, both from 1935, are the only two times ever that the United States Supreme Court has found a violation of the non-delegation doctrine, which doesn't directly say anything about what they'll do here, but might affect a betting man.
I'm sorry, there was Justice Breyer was during the argument was trying to paint Carter Cole as kind of a Lochner era remnant, and Tom Dupree did kind of go through a little bit of a riff like I just did about how the Supreme Court has recognized at least the principle in the courts of appeals, the principle in private party cases. He was definitely not trying to make kind of the strong form of the delegation doctrine argument, which, you know, even if this Amtrak was a governmental entity, the authority given to them was too vague to provide an intelligible principle.
Uh-huh.
So I'm sorry, I've cut you off.
No, that's fine. So my question is really about the due process argument, which, and a lot of people think Carter Cole is really a due process case, and there's due process running through a lot of this. But it's a quite concrete question, which was, did the justices seem to think that question was really before them? Because it wasn't, strictly speaking, ruled on by the court below, though it was briefed. The respondents proposed the question presented from the government is limited to non-delegation. The respondents proposed a second question presented, which would directly address the due process argument, and the court did not grant on that question. So, you know, I would have thought that there'd be a lot of hesitation on the court as to whether that was really before it or not.
You're quite right, and those are quite perceptive observations. Justice Ginsburg asked a somewhat confused question where I think she was trying to say what you just said, but it came out as saying this argument wasn't aired below, which is not quite right because it was briefed below. And Tom Dupree explained first that it was briefed at all levels of the case, that the district court rejected it, and that the D.C. Circuit, while it didn't address it, did in a footnote say they didn't see a lot of difference between the due process argument and the non-delegation argument.
Right.
Tom also argued that Carter Cole was really, I think he used the term, the font or the foundation really of Carter Cole was a due process concern. All that said, I was expecting to hear more about that's not in the question presented kind of thing at this argument, or more of a, you know, why are you asking us to reach something the D.C. Circuit didn't reach? And I didn't hear any of that. And there were a couple points where both Kagan and Sotomayor kind of agreed that a question they were asking, well, of course, you know, when they were basically pressing on is Amtrak part of the government, kind of recognizing, well, of course, for due process arguments, you know, I understand you may have a response for that. But there was not a lot of, I thought there was a surprisingly little pushback about whether the due process argument was really something they could be deciding or should be deciding in this case.
Interesting. Thanks.
All right. Well, it looks like we've got one more question pending, and then our lines will be open. So star and then the pound key.
This is Tom Casso from Chapman School of Law. I was wondering what kind of discussion they had on the arbitrator provision in the statute.
You know, I was a little surprised that there was not more discussion of it, because I actually thought that might be where they end up really deciding the case. There was an exchange where between Scalia and Mr. Gannon about that, about whether they had to be an officer, whether they could be an inferior or not inferior officer. Justice Scalia was definitely seemed to be very got his dander up when the government effectively suggested the arbitrator could be an inferior officer. Scalia thought that the arbitrator was not being supervised by anyone, and I think he was driving at, you know, that the arbitrator needed to be an officer of the United States. That ultimately didn't come up as much as I thought. But there was definitely that exchange about between Scalia and the assistant SG about that. And if you,
all right.
If you're,
well, looks like we've run out of questions. Let's do a last call. If you'd like to get in and ask our experts a question, press star and then the pound key. Oh, we looks like we had one more question jump on the line.
Yes, thanks. Just a follow-up to an earlier question. Did the issue of ripeness come up? I understood you to say basically this decision has to be followed by some enforcement action before it has any impact.
I wasn't trying to say this decision has to have any I wasn't trying to quite suggest that, but there is a ripeness aspect to it. But although it didn't come up, let me try to unpack that a bit. It is the metrics can serve for an enforcement action and may very well, satisfaction of the metrics may very well preclude an enforcement action. In addition, there is a requirement that the metrics that were agreed to be incorporated into the contracts between the railroads and Amtrak. The Amtrak and the railroads have these operating agreements which I think serve as contracts that govern their relationship. Sort of, in some ways, the regulatory structure gets translated into a contractual structure, and the statute obligated Amtrak to put these metrics, and they incorporated them to the extent practicable. There was a fair amount of discussion about what it meant to be to the extent practicable, and whether Amtrak could just, I mean, the railroads could just unilaterally refuse to do it, or whether this was a real requirement that meant that these metrics were going to effectively flow into these operating agreements and bind the railroads in a particular way. There was also a little bit of discussion of the fact that it appears it may be the case that this was a one-time job, if you will, that once this kind of, I'll call it rulemaking, but I'm putting air quotes around it, occurs, it'll never occur again, that the statute only foresees this happening once. And that raises some ripeness concerns, I guess, or suggests some ripeness concerns about the issue of the arbitrator, and to the fact that the arbitration was never invoked, you know, does one need to be concerned about this issue at all, because it's already happened, although the railroad's position is, even if it wasn't invoked, the presence of this arbitration influenced the Federal Railroad Administration to potentially compromise with Amtrak, because they couldn't be sure that they would prevail on an arbitration if they disagreed with Amtrak on what the metrics should be.
You mentioned also the Justice Breyer's list of horrors, what would happen if the court were to sustain the decision below. What might some of those felicitous events be that we could look forward to?
Well, it was kind of funny because he posed this parade of horribles question to the government, which made it harder for them. The government lawyer was not, Curtis wasn't quite sure whether he was supposed to be saying, yes, there will be a parade of horribles, so you have to reverse the decision, or I better not say there's going to be a parade of horribles in case the decision is affirmed. The lawyer for the AAR had an easier task, and he could quite clearly say, no, there's not a parade of horribles. The concern that I think Justice Breyer was saying is the government relies on private standard setting all the time. And to the extent you're now saying that when private parties set standards that can then have regulatory consequences, that's a delegation doctrine violation, that could be very problematic. AAR responded by saying, look, where that occurs, the usual circumstance this occurs is the government agency is the ultimate decider as to whether to incorporate the private standards into its regulations, that the FCC, to use Justice Breyer's example, can decide whether it is going to make these international standards, is going to adopt them and have them flow into its regulatory obligations, that there is not a direct delegation to the standard setter, the private standard setter, who then issues laws that have prescriptive effect on private parties without subsequent government action to endorse them or codify them. So, for example, NASDAQ, I think the markets often propose their own rules, but then they submit them to the SEC, and the SEC is the one who actually ultimately approves them or disapproves them. So even if, in the first instance, NASDAQ might write the rules, ultimately the SEC incorporates them, and like building codes might get incorporated into HUD regs this way. They don't happen, just Congress doesn't make them to give the private parties the authority to start regulating others. And that's the thrust of AAR's response as to why there won't be a parade of horribles here.
All right, well, we've got one more call on the line that we'll go right to.
Hi, David Tryon in Cleveland, Ohio. So I'm wondering if there's, assuming they, quote, breathe life back into the non-delegation doctrine. Will this have any impact on any other governmental action that we're currently looking at? Is there, you know, do you expect to see anything come from this?
I mean, the circumstances of this particular statute are pretty quirky, and so the ruling may not be a broad ruling that would launch kind of a new wave of delegation argument cases. Obviously, one would, you know, it's hard to know in advance of how broadly they write. If they write a due process argument, you know, one could see instances where you have these kind of quasi federal agencies, like Amtrak, maybe that might lead to broader challenges about, due process challenges to regulatory actions taken by quasi-private, quasi-public corporations. But, you know, on the facts of the case, you know, this statute is pretty unique, and it would be not hard to write a decision if the majority wanted to, if they want to uphold the D.C. Circuit. They could write a relatively narrow decision that really turned on the facts of these cases, in which case it might not be of substantial significance going forward.
Thanks.
All right. Well, before we end the call, I want to do one quick programming note. Our next scheduled Teleforum conference call will be this Wednesday, December 10th at 1 p.m., and that will be sponsored by our civil rights practice group on the possibility of the resurgence of the AKAKA bill for preferential treatment for Native Hawaiians. So, again, that's Wednesday, December 10th at 1 p.m. Since there are no more questions, I want to thank our expert, Mr. Beckner, for joining us and for going to the argument and for providing such a great explanation for all of us. We invite you to check out this podcast as well as other podcasts on our website, and stay tuned for our next scheduled Teleforum conference calls. So thank you, our audience, for joining us. And without anything else, we're adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.